Hi, this is Mark Sanford Gross from KGUA FM, Wallala, California. When I'm in Portland, which is often, I listen to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 on your FM.
Tune in to KBOO tonight at 8 o'clock for Squirrel Snow, the one show where we broadcast galactic awareness and animal awareness, where sometimes we have fascinating conversations with experts, authors, activists, and the fields of animal awareness and galactic awareness. And a lot of the time we play amazing music that could effectively raise your frequency of consciousness. Yes, that is Squirrel Snow, tonight at 8 o'clock, here on your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.
KBOO has a mobile app. You can listen to all your favorite shows, subscribe to KBOO podcasts, even set KBOO as your alarm clock. Just look for KBOO on the iTunes and Google Play Store. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star review.
Support for this broadcast comes from KBOO members and from Grand Lodge Concerts, presenting a co-headlining evening with John Craigie and Shook Twins on Saturday, July 29th, with special guests Steve Polks and Handmade Moments. Information and tickets for John Craigie and Shook Twins at GrandLodgeConcerts.com.
KBOO.
Good morning. Welcome to That Vegan Show. Today we have an organizer from Compassionate PDX. Her name is Amber Canavan. And I am your host and creator of the show, Melissa Lesniak. So Compassionate PDX is a grassroots group of volunteers that is dedicated to creating political change in favor of non-human animals. And we're going to learn more about their current campaigns of Fur Free Portland, Fur Free Oregon, and Foie Gras. So thanks so much for being here today, Amber.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So I'd love to hear more about how this organization got started and some of the history of animal rights in Oregon.
Yeah, I mean, I never set out to like become a lobbyist as a large chunk of the activism that I do, but several years ago when California just went and banned the sale of fur products in the entire state, it was a real kind of change in my mindset on how we could use the legal system to actually pass like actual animal rights legislation, because I've been working on these issues for decades at this point, and you know, the best you could usually hope for with lawmakers was, you know, very much welfare, or just trying to, you know, gain little inches from these industries that abuse animals. So like, or people that abuse animals, like tethering laws where you can still chain your dog out in the backyard, but for only a certain number of hours a day, or these cage-free laws that still only give the hens a square foot of space, things like that. And when the fur sale ban actually just went and said, you can't even sell this, it doesn't even matter whether it's got a humane label or any kind of standards attached to it, that really inspired me to try to do something similar in Oregon. And for one, Oregon is, you know, shares a border with California. We're on the West Coast. We're relatively progressive. And Oregon has some of the strongest, at least animal welfare laws in the country. We have really some of the oldest laws protecting dogs and cats and other animals. So I figured, you know, we should give it a try. And if some other place beats us to it, you know, more power to them. So I've been working on that for the past couple of years, starting strategically, we thought, in Portland, which I can talk a little bit about later. and now spreading to statewide and even up into Vancouver, Washington.
Yeah, I feel like I've been hearing a shift of activists, you know, really getting more involved with the legal side of it and the government side of it, you know, seeing that as a way to create the real change that we're looking for.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to get, I think, cultural changes and the beliefs of society to change. And you need to kind of get those to change at least to some extent to be able to get those, like, you know, codified into law at some point. So if we're ever going to achieve animal liberation, it's got to be put into law at some point. And we can chip away at, you know, banning bullhucks to get rid of the circuses and things like that on our way toward, you know, getting animals out of factory farms, getting them off of fur farms. California also, in the same swoop, kind of also banned trapping animals for their fur. There's some exemptions for when it's absolutely needed for so-called pest control, but the fact that you can't do it anymore just to serve the profit of an industry or as a hobby, that's also quite huge. I think we're probably pretty far away from ever being able to do that in Oregon, but with the way that we are really progressing things so much faster, relatively, it never feels like it in the moment, right? I've been doing this, I've been an activist since about 2001, and I thought I was going to be protesting Ringling Circus every year when it came through my city for the rest of my life. And lo and behold, a couple of years ago, Ringling had its last show in Long Island, and we don't even need to worry about protesting them anymore. So there's definitely progress happening. It never feels fast enough, but, you know, ultimately, I think all activists should be doing what their strengths are. So there's room for every kind of activism in the spectrum. And, you know, I still enjoy street protests and other organizing and stuff that I do. But yeah, the past couple of years have kind of invested in getting better at talking to lawmakers and trying to get some laws passed that are actually animal rights and not just animal welfare. I think that's what kind of sets us apart from other lobbying groups that are also doing great work in Oregon and elsewhere.
Yeah, sometimes the incremental change is tough. It seems like that's what tends to happen, but sometimes there gets to be a point where we need to take, I wish we could just take the leap, and we are seeing that more, somewhat more at least.
Yeah, I mean, things are, even with the pandemic, I think it was just right after the height of things really starting to get a little scary with the pandemic, Chicago banned horse-drawn carriages. You know, they were dealing with a lot of other things, and they still did it and got it done. And then the time that we've been working from scratch, trying to get some fur and foie gras bans passed here, either city or statewide, it's been like over a half dozen other cities across the country have passed fur sale bans. So, and we cheer them on, because every city that passes it is just another bit of weight, another bit of pressure and a bit of progress that other cities have less and less of an excuse. And, you know, they should just pass it as well.
Exactly. Yeah, it seems like once it starts passing in certain places, and, you know, eventually it can be a nationwide type thing. How did Compassionate PDX get started?
It was just me going to a couple of activists, friends that I knew, and saying, you know, look what California did, you know, let's try it here. And we've been working on building this this group up, this chapter. It's actually a part of the Compassionate Cities program, which is based in California. And I believe they are open to, you know, more chapters if people are located elsewhere, become part of the Compassionate Cities Coalition. And yeah, just very, very grassroots. And we do community events. We've done a lot of relationship building with our city, county, and state lawmakers, and working with a coalition of larger nonprofit groups so they can kind of provide the resources that we don't have being just a small volunteer group, and whether that's providing some legal review for the specific language that's in our draft legislation, because there's a lot of specifics on how you need to define things. Some cities and states aren't even allowed to pass a for sale ban because of something that's in the state constitution. So there are some complications, and it can really help to have coalition partners that have some more resources than you do. And we also got businesses and local nonprofits on board as well. And that really helps show that you've got the backing of the people that are their constituents. And that, at the end of the day, that's what they should at least care about.
Yeah, that's really smart to have the coalition and use other states as a model. I know when I was still living in St. Louis and wanting to move to Portland, I would try to emulate some of the things that were being done here instead of, you know, and that way I kind of had, oh, that's a great idea. Let's try to do that here. So that makes a lot of sense. Since it's Earth Month, I wanted to also kind of touch on some of the environmental impacts of your campaigns, or not of your campaigns, but of what you're trying to do. And then we'll dig more deeply into the campaigns.
Yeah, I mean, Oregon cares about the environment. We have so many great parks, and we have the ocean, we have the mountains, lots of wildlife here. So that's been a big selling point when we've talked to lawmakers. There's a really great mini documentary called The Farm in My Backyard, and you can watch it online for free. And it's a documentary about how fur factory farming basically ruined this one town in Canada, where, you know, a large percentage of the population has literally fur farms in their backyards. There's communities across the United States that are also engaged in this kind of thing, where for whatever reason, a large percentage of the people there started fur farms literally in their backyard. And you can go ahead and do that in most places. It's very poorly regulated. And, you know, these places have the same problems as a factory farm does that's raising cows, pigs, or chickens. So there's water pollution, air pollution, the ammonia gets into the air, the nitrogen gets in, and bacteria gets into the waterways. And there's also the disease vector issue. In Oregon, during the height of the pandemic, we found out that one of the fur farms in Oregon had an outbreak of COVID-19 in their mink population, which is, one, not surprising, because anytime you're cramming animals into factory farm conditions where they're crammed into cages in stress conditions, they'll often have wounds on their feet or other parts of their body from the wire mesh materials that their cages are made out of. And that was a huge issue. The state actually was working with the fur industry to try to keep it secret which farm it was.
Wow.
So currently there are five or less fur farms that we know of, because luckily enough, Oregon does treat fur farms as CAFOs, so they do have to register a certain amount of information with the state. There's other states that literally have no idea if or how many fur farms they are, because they are just these fly-by-night, put up some cages in your backyard and make a profit type of operations. There's absolutely no oversight or regulation touching these places in some states. In Oregon, at least we have some bare minimum, but you know, it was very clear that the Oregon Department of Agriculture was working with the fur industry to try to protect them during this outbreak at the fur farm, and trying to protect, it seemed like, the fur industry's reputation, even though they were creating this huge potential public health threat. When animals are crammed together on factory farms and an outbreak happens, one, you're having lots of interchange of these disease between the animals themselves. Mm-hmm. There's also contamination concerns with wildlife that have no choice but to come in contact with them. And in Oregon, they actually did find that mink trapped in the vicinity of this fur farm were also testing positive. So mink were escaping from this farm. There's also concern, we do have deer in Oregon. So deer populations were also being affected by COVID-19 across the country. And then of course the workers. So slaughterhouses for, you know, cows, pigs, and chickens were hotspots for COVID-19 outbreaks because of the close and dirty conditions that these workers were forced into to keep going, to keep those slaughter lines going, even while workers were getting sick and dying. They did not shut those places down unless they were absolutely forced to. There's absolutely a worker health and safety issue for farms operating in the United States. Mink are particularly susceptible to respiratory diseases. So not only do we have, you know, potentially the next iteration of COVID, but avian flu is also tearing through the country. It's over 50 million domestic birds, so farm birds, chickens, turkeys, have already been killed from avian flu. It's just a matter of time before swine flu makes its resurgence. These are all just disasters waiting to happen. We actually did, I guess I'm going off on a bit of a tangent, but we did actually get a fur farming ban introduced last session. Wonderful. And it did get a hearing, but ultimately did not pass. And that was largely based on the public health threat. But unfortunately, the fur industry lobbyists made enough of a stink and were able to get it not past that session, but there's always next session.
Right. I'm sure it's incredibly disappointing, but it sounds like you also know from experience that you just keep being resilient and going back. And, you know, you have seen some improvements or, you know, some laws passed over time. But it takes a long time. Let's go ahead and dig a little deeper and hear more details about the campaigns.
Yeah, so while the ultimate goal has always been like getting something passed statewide, we decided to start with the city of Portland. We got very, very close to passing a fur sale ban with the city of Portland. Unfortunately, the main champion in the city council actually passed away from cancer kind of midway through things, put a damper. Commissioner Fish, his office was so great. He was really concerned about water conservation. So the fact that factory farms, including fur farms, are impacting waterways, I think really spoke to them. But, you know, Portland's got a lot of issues involving cost of living, homelessness, drugs, the list goes on. And as time went on and we were just kind of on this treadmill with them about when when they could actually move forward with this type of legislation. And, you know, they ended up having us go to the county, and the county said, of course, no, it's on the city. You know, it was never an issue of we don't support this or you know, not an important issue. It's just the city is just so consumed by these other pressing issues, which, I mean, I mentioned Chicago's got issues. It still passed the horse carriage ban. New York City's got issues. It passed the foie gras sales ban and just banned the sale of guinea pigs in pet stores the other week. There's definitely a precedent for cities that have very, very large, ongoing, complicated challenges that can still pass animal rights legislation. So we don't really completely buy it that it was impossible to fit in this legislation that we demonstrated clearly that Portlanders support, ended up getting 5,000 handwritten, like paper signed signatures, not just online signatures. Over 50 businesses and nonprofits signed on to endorse it. We had our, you know, great rallies for Free Friday and things like that. But that was kind of our strategy to get it passed in Portland, to help show statewide that something like this could happen in Portland. As life goes, it didn't really work out that way. And we were able to get the fur sale ban introduced into the Oregon state legislature the past two sessions in a row. And unfortunately, a couple weeks ago, we did have the HB 3390, the fur sale ban, introduced and had a hearing in the House side of the legislature. But there was kind of this guillotine day where a bunch of bills died that week. They had to winnow things down quite a bit. And unfortunately, our bill was on the chopping block that week. So, but, you know, these things are kind of a long game, especially when you're trying to pass legislation that is, you know, quite new to some of these lawmakers. And, you know, there's a lot of work you have to do to get them to understand the issues. So, you know, we're in it for the long haul. And every time we get it introduced and get it just a little bit farther than last year or last session, you know, that is also a win. It's a big amount of time and resources wasted for the fur industry having to defend itself across, you know, multiple different cities, because even though you know,
Oregon, that way, yeah,
yeah, I mean, that's you know, at the very least, you know, they had to instead of spending time promoting their industry and increasing their sales however they can, because, you know, the public you know, overwhelmingly doesn't support the sale of fur. Designers have stopped using it. Canada Goose was a huge one because most stores in Oregon, you know, were very much plaid and flannel type of place.
Right.
So you're not going to see like super fashionable fur trim coats most of the time here. It would be the, you know, the hiking jackets with the coyote or raccoon dog fur on the hoods was, you know, the vast majority of what you would find. And, you know, while I'm talking about our struggles and defeats, which I think is important to talk about and how we can improve, and you don't always win the first round. And I think that kind of perseverance is really important for activists to understand.
Oh, I was just saying, definitely. And yeah, when you were talking about what was happening in Portland, it definitely sounded like there was some passing the buck going on.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I think that's great that you just elevated it to the next level. So,
absolutely. And, you know, as much of a defeat of like, okay, we probably aren't going to get Portland to pass a fur sale ban anytime in the super near future, while it grapples with these like pretty crazy humanitarian issues that are happening here and other cities too. I mean, the methamphetamine and fentanyl, all that stuff it's affecting cities all over the country. I saw a headline the other day that said, Portland police seize enough fentanyl to kill the entire city in, you know, raid this week. I just assumed it was Portland. It was actually Portland, Maine. So Portland, Maine is having this issue too. You don't really think of them as being, you know, having troubles like that. But yeah, I think, you know, it's a good point. Everywhere is struggling with these issues, and but we're keeping on and keep pushing these issues, because the animals are still suffering behind those locked doors and gates this entire time. And that's part of what keeps me going too, is as tough as the world seems, there's a reason to keep fighting, because these animals are suffering. And also the factory farming of mink and cows and pigs and chickens, it's harming us too. It's
right.
Killing the oceans. It's causing the climate catastrophe. It's probably going to cause the next major disease outbreak that shuts down our economy again. These are all issues that are very, very much interconnected that we need to address.
Right. What are some of the arguments you hear, like why we wouldn't want to ban fur?
Well, I'll tell you, when we were out petitioning in the streets of Portland and hearing from people, it was really funny the number of people that said, oh, I thought it was already banned. I was like, oh, that's sweet.
Every time I hear it come up, I'm like, wait, we're still doing this?
Well, and one of the things I was also going to mention was that over the course of this time of us trying to get this law passed, Portland has become a de facto fur-free city. So we've gotten all of the retailers that are in the city, small to large, to stop selling fur. So there was an outdoor store that was selling a lot of Canada Goose. They stopped selling that. And then Canada Goose went for free sometime later. We had a very large flagship Nordstrom store downtown, right on Pioneer Square. They went for free. There were some boutiques and things like that. And then one of our biggest victories also was Mario's, which is like a high-end fashion store with a couple locations, including up in Seattle. And we got them to institute a fur-free policy after many, many protests there. So there is light in that tunnel. And again, there's often peripheral, whenever there's a defeat, there's often like a side victory with it. Mm-hmm. So even though we don't have this law in Portland, we're still technically a fur-free city. I'm just going to go out and say that right now.
Yeah. So yeah, that's why I was wondering. So that you do protest and like you have could just have communication with the owners of these stores in other ways?
Yeah. We had written to them. They definitely heard from customers about it, leafleting, chalking, all sorts of stuff, working with them to just get them to stop selling the, they sold some Canada Goose jackets. They had some like fox fur, like really fancy women's gloves and like little, you know, just very unnecessary items to have real fur on them. And we got them to stop. So
that's great. Yeah. It's kind of interesting because, you know, we hear with, you know, eating meat, a lot of people are like, oh, I want to eat my meat or whatever their reasons are. But it almost sounds like people think fur is already banned and then, but it's not.
Like, yeah.
Like you almost wonder if, I don't know, I'm getting.
I mean, I'll tell you all the arguments the fur industry has, mm-hmm. but as far as most, you know, normal people go, they can either choose the garment that doesn't have fur trim on it at all, or there is faux fur, which I personally don't really like the look of, but
right.
People really want it. Yeah, you can find even biodegradable versions of fur. And that is, you know, if we're talking about the environment in particular right now, the fur industry does have a lot of propaganda out there about how faux fur is just made out of plastic and real fur is more sustainable and biodegradable, which is completely false. There's been cradle to grave studies on fur, and the amount of resources and toxic chemicals that go into the fur You know, it's a, at the end of the day, it's a toxic product, to the point where there was a study done about how you probably shouldn't let the fur touch your skin because of the chemicals in it could be impacting you. So it's funny to me that they'll argue about microplastics and that it's plastic, and it's true. Some of those products are made from plastic, often recycled plastic, but I don't see the fur industry going out and, you know, being upset about any other. The vast majority of people are not vegan, and are not choosing these products. It's, you know, they only care about it to cherry pick it and try to make an attack. They don't really care about microplastics. If they did, they would be going, you know,
right.
They'd be upset with these fast fashion companies that are producing all these things and selling and promoting all these things. But they only care about it when it's a direct threat to their sales.
Right. So apparently there is a market for it somewhere. Is there like a market for it more in other countries, or is it more kind of high end?
For real fur?
Yeah.
Most of the fur sold in the United States now is trim. And that's kind of how the industry got around this like widespread cultural shift, you know, not supporting fur, as they started putting it on little trim and trinkets. They started dyeing it. They started kind of shaving or sculpting it, so it actually looked a little more like fake fur. So for a little while, they did get it kind of back into fashion by selling it in fast fashion stores. So Forever 21 and H&M and all those kind of stores that you would find in the mall. And advocates, animal advocates, did do a great job over the years and got fur-free policies at pretty much all of them. I remember in my early 20s going out and protesting, I think it was Bebe, I didn't even know how to pronounce it, and Forever 21 and Wet Seal, and one by one, all those companies, you know, once one stopped selling it, the others, you know, over the course of a couple of years followed. So yeah, luckily, I mean, the malls used to be full of weird little fur trim products all over the place, and that's not the case anymore either. And I think that's another, you know, sign of progress that's not, maybe not necessarily visible to activists now. So you never really see how bad it would have been if people hadn't have done the activism that they did. So activists coming into the scene now might, you know, might feel overwhelmed by, we have the National Primate Research Center over here in Beaverton. We've got rodeos. We've got, you know, we've got everything here. There's no shortage of campaigns and issues for us to work on, but you know, we don't need to protest the circus once or twice a year when it comes through town. We don't need to protest the like 8 stores that used to sell nothing but fur in Portland. During the Fur Free Friday protest last year, we actually did this tour where we marched, and the route was visiting all of the old buildings that used to be actual, like, sell nothing but fur stores around Portland. And, you know, one was a hair salon now, another was a shoe shop. And, you know, you would never know it now walking around Portland that there used to be so much fur, like an entire store set dedicated to selling this stuff. And it's just not there anymore. We don't even need to worry about it. I mean, don't get me wrong, there's so much work to do. There's billions of animals being slaughtered every year for their flesh, for their milk, for their fur, for their skins, right, for their feathers. But I mean, just the past couple of decades, the amount of work that activists have put in, we're really just standing on their shoulders. And, you know, there's so many issues that we don't need to worry about and can focus on these other issues because of the work people did. And all the activism I try to do, you know, I try to think that way. I'm kind of clearing the way for other activists that are coming in and stepping into that role. And you know, they're going to get that much farther.
Yeah, I think that's a really innovative, creative idea to, you know, go to all the places that, you know, did sell fur and that can, you know, help people see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Mm-hmm. Because,
you know, sometimes it just does feel overwhelming and daunting. And so to see that change that actually happened, I think is really important to highlight that. And then, you know, all the other things that still need to happen.
Absolutely.
Tell us more about the foie gras campaign.
Yeah, so I have a special history with foie gras. So I was an undercover cruelty investigator, and I've actually been on a foie gras farm.
Mm.
I was prosecuted and spent a month in jail for collecting video footage from Hudson Valley foie gras. And as much as I work on fur and other issues, foie gras has a special place in my, I won't say heart, but has a special place in my activism. So as part of our kind of wider strategy of trying to get local legislation passed before going statewide, Washington, you know, we've got the border right here in Oregon. So we have a lot of people who live in Vancouver, Washington, right over the river. And Washington's also been on a similar trajectory. It's been working on introducing there's activists working on introducing a fur sale ban in the city of Seattle. They've been working on introducing a fur farm ban and a fur sale ban. So even though it's technically a different state, if Vancouver were to pass a fur sale ban or foie gras ban or both, we're working on both at the same time, you know, that would also kind of put a little bit of a fire under Portland's butt to say, look, Vancouver's right across the river and they did this.
Right.
You know, what are you guys doing here? So yeah, for about the past 6 or 8 months, we heard from some Vancouver residents who wanted to work on these issues and found a couple of open city council members who are really great and wanted to learn more about animal issues and introduce something. So we've been working with them on both the fur issue, and they were open on the foie gras issue as well. And we've had a workshop, and it sounds like they're going to be going toward like a resolution first. We couldn't quite get them to commit to an actual ordinance that would have enforceable rules, which is, to be honest, quite a letdown.
Right.
But we're trying to keep the door open that, you know, that's the route that they are going to be going at this time. And of course, there's the argument that they're starting to face some of the issues that Portland has been facing. But again, there's never going to be the right time to do this. Cities are always going to be facing a mountain of issues.
Enough of us, like you said earlier, to do multiple things at the same time, or, you know, hold multiple things and work on them.
Absolutely. So, yeah. So we're working with Vancouver, and that, you know, that fits in kind of with that broader strategy of getting something passed at the city level to help give that, just show the homework basically to the state lawmakers that something like this can pass in that state, or at least in a neighboring city right across the border, and just get something started. So that's kind of where we're at now. And, you know, we're going to keep working with our state lawmakers to try to get that fur sale ban reintroduced with some slightly tweaked language to try to help make it more insulated from arguments from the animal abusing industries that oppose it in the next session.
Okay. And you said New York has banned it?
New York City has banned the sale of foie gras. Yep.
Anywhere else in the United States?
California.
Okay.
Yep. California. California, California.
The normal progression, huh?
Yeah. Like,
it's where things tend to start and then they spread.
Yeah. And given that, so the enforcement of the New York City ban is on hold right now because of legal challenges from the industry, which, you know, is completely expected. But again, I would say that that is still a win because the foie gras industry is having to go on the defensive and defend itself
right.
from these things. And New York City is a huge market, and the farm is in New York, so they really benefit. They're from a little bit more upstate, so they're a couple hours away from New York City, but you know, they benefit from this pretty misleading, you know, we're local type advertising to New York City people. It's like you're a local right. factory farm is what you are. But
right. And the I tend to block it out because it's so disturbing, but they, you know, they do force feeding and things like that, right?
Yeah, so foie gras is the diseased bloated liver of a duck or goose who's been force-fed. By the end of the process, their livers are up to 10 times their normal size.
Wow.
And this is exploiting these migratory birds' natural ability to store fat in their organs. So if they're migrating, they're not going to be eating, and they need to store all that energy to migrate somewhere. Yeah. And, you know, humans are very interesting creatures, and they noticed that killing a duck or goose right ahead of migration, that their livers, you know, were larger and tastier. And that got kind of bastardized and turned into this extremely exploitative and painful and absolutely disgusting practice of shoving a tube down their throats and force feeding them much, much more than they would ever naturally gorge for migration, and confining their movement, and then slaughtering them for this luxury product that gets sold in like French restaurants for a lot of money.
Mm. And the people who eat it, I guess, know that that's how it happens, or I guess we don't know.
Many don't. They just see it as this interesting, expensive menu item that they can impress, you know, their friends by trying, and chefs will put it on the menu just to impress other foodies with that they have the, you know, the skills to cook this exotic product. But yeah, a lot of people don't know, because the foie gras industry has a very robust marketing theme. So they will very much market themselves as, they'll use artisanal, local, cage-free, which is completely meaningless because they're kept in a pen. So sure, that's not a cage, but they're kept tend to a pen on mesh wire flooring. So they don't even have anywhere to rest. They're always standing on wire flooring. And there's literally a, basically an open sewer under their pens, that they're suspended over like a vat of their own feces and waste. And they have a manure lagoon just like any other factory farm does.
Right.
Yeah, it's absolutely ridiculous. And as I mentioned in testifying to the New York City Council and the Vancouver City Council, just like mink, ducks and geese are semi-aquatic animals. So to deny them access to water is one of those things that is this kind of silent suffering, that we're depriving them of something that is so essential to their well-being, and hurting their mental health and their physical health, the ability to groom and maintain their bodies. It's just one of those things that humans are so stupid and inconsiderate sometimes that we would even think it's acceptable in any way to deprive a semi-aquatic animal of the ability to to go into water. So on fur farms, mink are just given like a water bottle or a dish. And on the foie gras farms, it was a PVC pipe with part of the top cut off of it that was flowing past them. And they had to reach their necks through the bars of their pen to sip out of like maybe a half inch of water. It's just,
wow.
Of all the other cruelties, the force feeding being the main one and being forced to live on a factory farm, obviously being cruel. The fact that they could never even stand in a puddle of water and bathe themselves like you see ducks in the park doing is, you know, such deprivation and very, very sad for them.
I could go on and on. This is the only thing I don't like about doing this show is learning, you know, more ways that us humans are cruel to animals, you know, that I already know, which is more than, you know, I wish I had to know, but I really appreciate you explaining it, you know, fully to people who may not have been aware of everything that is, you know, going on with the cruel practices there. Earlier, you touched upon like how all of this, like animal rights, kind of goes along with the pandemic. And I wanted to talk about that a little bit more and how, you know, that could affect our future.
Well, I mean, I hate to say it, but the pandemic definitely did put a damper on activism. So I'll put that plug in right now that I'm still struggling to kind of come out of the pandemic shell. I attended technically 3 protests this week. It just happened that there were a bunch of events that all kind of converged this week. There's also Earth Day events coming up and more protests against OHSU for both its primate laboratory. And I'll just mention really quickly OHSU's use of live pigs in its OBGYN trainings for residency students. So if people are in Portland or have any kind of connection to OHSU or reproductive health, it would be very helpful to write or email or call OHSU and ask them to stop using live pigs in their OBGYN residency programs. Most medical schools don't use this anymore, and the Department of Defense doesn't use it anymore. OHSU is really stuck in the past year. So I'll just mention that because I was at a protest at the OHSU Board of Directors meeting this week, and I think things are going to be stepping up on that issue in the near future. So that's my plug to please get active. I know it's weird to be around people in person and going out to attend events, and inflation and job issues are, you know, really issues that are impacting everyone right now. But at least for me, activism is that antidote to despair.
Yes.
In many cases. So, and building back those communities that we, in many ways, very much lost with the pandemic. We have to rebuild those connections and get people to come back out of the woodwork and kind of come back out of our pandemic shells that we have built.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely feel that to some level, like kind of got comfortable being at home more and less to kind of deal with. And
yeah.
Oh, but I mean, also some people, you know, some or most people need some level of social interaction. And, you know, also, you know, I've talked on past shows about social connection even helps you, you know, like if you're a newer vegan to stay vegan. If you're just a vegan and everybody around you is not vegan, that's not, you know, it's helpful to have that social support or even advice if you need it, or, you know, just to feel like you're part of something bigger in that way, that other people share your beliefs.
Yeah, absolutely. And we do try to either go out to eat, you know, together, either before or after protests and other actions too. There's social events too, just strictly social events too, for people to dip their toes in. But yeah, so more specifically about, you wanted me to talk about different diseases that come from animals, or
some of that. There definitely seems like there could be more of these pandemics coming, and your knowledge on that would be welcome for sure.
Well, I mean, just starting with bird flu, I mentioned, you know, about 50 million birds have been killed on U.S. farms alone. There's some really awful articles from Japan, because it's in Japan right now. They don't have a lot of land. They're actually running out of land to try to bury all of the chickens who died from avian flu outbreaks there, because they just don't have the land mass to do it. We've seen the same thing with natural disasters in the United States. So like when hurricanes would hit on the, you know, shores of North Carolina and Georgia and all these states that are known for having high concentrations of either pig or chicken factory farms, like these farms aren't prepared. They have far too many animals to be able to handle a natural disaster, and they're not required to either. And the state, meaning taxpayers, end up footing the bill for these industries who just rebuild on the same property again. It's absolute insanity.
It's heartbreaking and devastating when you just see how these animals, I'm tearing up, but you know, how they just let them be there and die in the natural disaster. You know?
And the worst thing is that was probably a better death for them than what was waiting for them if they made it through the entire factory farming process. If they survived the factory farm, you know, they had an even worse fate waiting for them, you know, being on a transport truck for a day or more with no food or water in all weather extremes. There's no laws protecting them aside from this very lax and inadequate 20-hour law in the United States. And then, you know, of course, nothing humane ever happens in a slaughterhouse. But I mentioned the natural disasters because we had, you know, technically a natural disaster as well with the supply chain issues during COVID. So I mentioned slaughterhouses were still operating despite the very heavy risk they were putting their very underpaid and endangered workers in. Some of them did end up shutting down or having such bad outbreaks that their production lines were slowed down enough. Meanwhile, the factory farms were still breeding and, you know, producing more animals into that pipeline instead of saying, hey, wait a minute, there's not going to be anywhere for these animals to go. And they've bred more and more. So they were mass killing animals on factory farms through method called ventilation shutdown or ventilation shutdown plus, which again, of all of the things that should have never, ever, ever have been invented by humanity, including factory farming, you know, these farms have so many animals. It's a football field sized shed with sometimes at least tens of thousands, if not millions, of animals in one building. And those animals all need to breathe. So they rely on these giant fans at the end of each shed to kind of bring this airflow through. Otherwise, the air will become completely unbreathable. I mean, it's already unbreathable when you're in there. The times that I've been on a factory farm, it's stuck in your nostrils even after you take a hot, hour-long shower.
Amber, sorry to interrupt. The time is sneaking up on me.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. We could go on for a long time about factory farms, and I appreciate you sharing that knowledge because I think people just don't realize all the atrocities. But I did want to give you a chance to tell us what are some of the other coalition cities that work with passionate PDX.
Yeah. we're part of the Compassionate Cities Coalition. They're based in like Berkeley and San Francisco, the Bay Area. You can lobby from anywhere that you are, either your city, no matter how small it is. So like the last city to pass a for sale ban was a small city in Massachusetts. And they're like one of four pretty small cities in Massachusetts. A small city in Michigan also passed it. So no matter where you are, I think don't let that stop you from working on a for sale ban or other type of animal rights legislation. I will say the for sale bans are my personal favorite because they are feeding into this larger kind of national campaign. And also they're already pre-drafted for you. So you're coming to the lawmakers with something that's already been kind of battle tested and proven that it can pass somewhere else. And it, you're just doing as much of the work for the city council as you can. You're taking as much of that load off of them as you can. So we work with, we kind of cover Oregon, and we also help in Washington. If anyone is in Oregon or Washington, please follow us on social media and get in touch if you want to be more involved.
Yeah, but, what's your website, Amber?
It's compassionatepdx.org.
Okay. So yeah, if people want to find out more about you, they can go to that website, and I will also post it on the KBOO episode page that links to this episode. So if you're driving around in your car and can't write that down right now, you can check there. Well, thanks so much for being on the show and all the hard work you've been doing for the animals.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah.
And join us next month. That Vegan Show is always on the fourth Friday at 11 a.m. on KBOO.
Yeah. You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy viernes 28 de julio del 2023. Las Naciones Unidas han advertido que la decisión de Rusia de rescindir el acuerdo de cereales del Mar Negro, que permitía la exportación segura de alimentos y fertilizantes desde los puertos ucranianos, provocará un aumento vertiginoso de los precios de los alimentos y un empeoramiento del hambre en todo el mundo. Esto ocurre